Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, sitting in for Brian. The headlines, of course, have been dominated by some big legislation over the first 18 months of the Obama administration. We've had stimulus bills, healthcare reform, financial regulation. What we haven't had during that period, according to our first guest, is a sober and clear discussion about how we're going to pay for these new plans. He's Jim Himes, the Democratic congressman from Connecticut's 4th District, and he joins us now to tell us why he thinks neither side of the aisle is being responsible about how much the government is spending, as well as to weigh in on all things financial, from tax cuts to financial reform. Congressman Himes, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Delighted to be with you.
It's Isaac, actually, filling in for Brian.
Hi, Isaac.
But
I will
do my best to be Brian. Tell us about your gang of four, these House Democrats who are splitting with the leadership over how much the government is spending. Politico called it a revolt. Are you revolting?
Well, I'm not. Politico called it that. We didn't call it that. The point we're trying to make here is that all too often, and all too often as we approach November, the debate about fiscal responsibility is going to be silly. People are going to say, oh, it's terribly important that we get our fiscal house in order. The thing that's hard is the next question, which is how? How are you going to do that? And, you know, neither leadership, neither the Democratic nor the Republican leadership, has made a good faith effort, really, to put out there a plan that is in any way credible. So we just said, okay, we're going to get specific. We as Democrats, and Democrats are always accused of being unwilling to put forward cuts, just as Republicans are, I think, fairly accused of never being willing to contemplate revenue. We said we're going to put forward some cuts. And so we put together a series of bills that in their aggregate would cut $70 billion from the budget over a 10-year period, which, of course, isn't going to fix it, but it is hopefully a statement of leadership saying, let's get specific here.
Well, first, let's be clear. I mean, do you disagree with the president that the stimulus has been working? Would you rather we hadn't spent that money?
No, not at all. Not at all. Very much to the contrary. When we were voting on the stimulus, there were economists in the hallways here in Congress, and not a single one from the left to the right, from Robert Reich to Larry Lindsey, disagreed that a stimulus was absolutely essential to keep the economy from spiraling into the ditch. You know, the Republicans are trying to make an awful lot of electoral hay over the concept that the stimulus hasn't worked, but there's not an economist that agrees with that. The reality is that the stimulus was responsible for saving or preserving or creating somewhere between 2.5 and 3 million jobs. Now, that doesn't feel good to anybody, and frankly, most people don't believe it because, 8 million people still lost their jobs. So, you know, the combination of the stimulus, the Federal Reserve's activities, and, you know, expanding its balance sheet turned this economy from spiraling into a depression to where we are today, which is tenuous, slow growth.
But, of course, it could be worse is a hard argument to sell, obviously.
Nobody wins elections on the situation would have been a lot worse but for me.
Well, you said you have this set of bills that would reduce the deficit by, did you say, $70 billion over how many years?
Over 10 years, it would reduce the deficit by $70 billion, which, you know, is really a rounding error. But the point is that it starts the discussion. It gets us going. It puts some specifics on the table.
Well, so what are some of the specifics in these bills? What are you looking to cut?
Well, we tried to focus on those things that, you know, there was some agreement on the part of the executive and others that were either wasteful or perhaps obsolete. I'll give you one example from a bill that I put forward. As so often happens, back in the early 2000s, there were subsidies put forward for worsted wool manufacturers because the trade law around that changes. Well, subsidies are put in place to help the worsted wool manufacturers, and they're supposed to fade, but of course they didn't. So my bill, amongst other provisions, would do away with those subsidies, would get at some of the agricultural subsidies. Other people's bills, like we've looked at the HUD budget, we've looked at the defense budget, you know, that's $700 billion in savings, which, you know, all too often has been considered a sacred cow, particularly when our troops are engaged and in harm's way. But, if we're going to be serious about this, there will be no sacred cows. People will come to the table and be willing to contemplate anything because that's the magnitude of the problem.
Well, and in fact, I know that Barney Frank and Ron Paul have been in sort of a strange bedfellows roadshow about cutting the military budget and the Pentagon budget. I think that at least one of them, if not both, has even gone so far as to say we should consider pulling U.S. troops out of Europe entirely. Are these the kinds of things that need to be considered now, given what you see as this looming deficit issue?
Everything needs to be considered. You know, when we've got $12 trillion in debt, when we've got unfunded liabilities in Medicare and Social Security that get us into the sort of $50 trillion neighborhood, everything needs to be considered. And yes, we have to have a robust national conversation about, not just Germany and Europe, but what do we feel? I mean, particularly in the face of the release of these documents, what do we feel about $100 billion every single year in Afghanistan?
As you're referring to the documents that from WikiLeaks about 92,000 reports from on the ground in Afghanistan showing a pretty
exactly.
grim picture.
Which, you know, as concerned as we all are about the fact that classified information was leaked, you know, it really paints a picture that we've all suspected was true of how challenging the endeavor in Afghanistan is. And remember, apart from the lives that we're losing over there, it's $100 billion every single year. We have to have this conversation. Now, that's separate from the Pentagon, right? The Pentagon's budget is $700 billion. I don't think there are many people who are going to say that in a $700 billion budget, you can't find a couple of percentage points of savings. And there you're talking about real money.
But do you really think that? I mean, are there really people? I feel like there are quite a few people you could find who would say, no, there is no savings to be found in that $700 billion. I mean, as you were saying, the military budget can be seen as pretty sacrosanct. I mean, from your position on the Hill, do you feel like there is political change in this arena, that there could actually be some movement toward cutting the military budget, which has, especially over the last 10 years or so, been pretty much a non-starter?
Sure. Look, I think there's two sets of people, neither standing on principle that raises hell over the prospect of reducing the military budget. The first is, and this is really sort of an insidious problem, you know, there is no part, there is no weapon, there is no project so small in the Pentagon that it's not made in, you know, dozens of different congressional districts. And of course, we as congresspeople have a responsibility to stand up for jobs in our district, particularly now. So that creates some really tough issues. The other thing, of course, is just the sheer politics. You know, there will be those who will want to say, you know, who will want to take sort of a responsible and careful look at the DOD budget and use that against somebody and say, look, they want to cut the budget of our troops when they're in harm's way. So, you know, neither of those are arguments in principle. Look, you've got Senator Tom Coburn, who's as conservative as anybody out there, who has persistently voted against the wars because he makes the very good point that if we are going to go to war, we darn well should find a way to pay for it. I do think that the world is a little bit different now because people are becoming conscious of how very, very severe this fiscal situation is.
Speaking of things that are somewhat sacrosanct, you had mentioned that one of your bills would target some agriculture subsidies. And, of course, agriculture subsidies are another one of these sort of third rails in Washington. I mean, one of the reasons that they very rarely get taken on is that when agriculture subsidies get taken on, it turns into this huge fight that many people end up feeling is not worth all the effort just to cut this small amount because there's such a lobby around them. Do you feel that you could really have success in taking on some of these agriculture subsidies?
Well, everything here is a fight, and everything is subject to parochial interest. We see this day in and day out. Do we really believe, do the four of us believe that the cuts we've proposed here are all going to sail through easily? Not at all. But we do want to achieve two things. One is, don't say you're fiscally responsible unless you come to the table with some ideas, because really the first thing is easy to say. It's the second thing that is hard to say, which is, how do you do it? And secondly, if you come to me and say, no, these three agricultural subsidy cuts are really bad ideas, despite the fact that the president has identified them as good ideas and we've looked at them and think that they're good ideas, that's fine. You may know the situation better than we do. But then propose an alternative. Come to the table with something affirmative. We're beyond the point where people can just stand for their parochial interests without coming with savings. This is something I'm doing in my office. You know, my office, day in and day out, I have meeting after meeting with wonderful organizations, the American Heart Association, Juvenile Diabetes, you name it. And, of course, the request is always the same, and it involves additional resources. And that's wonderful. I mean, I think we should invest more money in juvenile diabetes research and coronary research and all that good stuff. But I have to ask, you know, what's the return? And if we're going to add, since we live under PAYGO rules now, which, by the way, we didn't under the Bush administration, if we live under PAYGO rules, where can we cut? Help me here, because I can't just go to the floor every single day and say, we need more money for these 15 wonderful projects.
I want to move on to talking about the financial reform bill in just a moment. But one last question, which is on that point. it's very similar, I think, to what we hear a lot of people in Washington saying, which, and certainly President Obama has said this several times, as Americans have to tighten their belts in these tough economic times, the federal government also should be doing the same. And I'm wondering if you think that isn't that sort of a false parallel, because, in fact, in these tough economic times, the federal government is the only entity that can actually deficit spend when no one else has any money. Isn't this, in fact, exactly the time, as many economists are arguing, to spend more and not to be cutting?
Yeah, and that's the big question, Isaac, and I want to be very clear on this because it gets so politicized. Look, I voted and I will defend my vote to my dying day in favor of the stimulus. You know, when we were on the precipice looking into a new depression, that was the right vote and the right thing to do. Not a single economist that came to Congress disputed that. In fact, most of the economic world today is sort of coalescing around the view that that stimulus was too small. Now, we're in a very different situation right now. It doesn't feel that way to most Americans, but instead of GDP contracting at 6% a year, it's actually growing at a little over 5% a year. Instead of losing 700,000 jobs every month, we're actually adding tens and a couple hundred thousand private sector jobs. We're in a very, very different world. Now is the moment not to slash budgets. Again, that's a political statement. It's a stupid idea. You slash budgets in the face of a very tenuous recovery, you really risk a replay of 1937 and dumping this economy into a double dip. Now is the moment to signal political willingness and ability to come together to craft a plan, a long-term plan for a return to responsibility. That doesn't mean slashing. It means coming to the table in good faith with ideas and being willing to talk about those sacred cows and being willing to dial back as the economy improves.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC AM and FM and on the web at WNYC.org. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson filling in for Brian, and I'm talking with Connecticut Congressman Jim Himes about the deficit and financial regulation. Let's move on to the financial reform bill that just passed. Broadly, what do you think of it? Did it turn out the way you'd like?
Yeah, you know, it was always an exercise, Isaac, in balancing the need to have a vibrant, innovative, growing, tax-paying, employing financial service sector, which does what that sector is supposed to do, which is to intermediate capital, with the need to never have them go. And by them, I mean everybody. I mean the mortgage brokers and the banks and the brokerage houses and, frankly, the credit rating agencies and the SEC. To not have them go where they went in the last 10 years, you know, this gorging on debt, this subprime insanity. And that was always a tough balance because, of course, it happened to have occurred in the context of the whitest hot emotion that anybody had ever seen around here because, of course, of the bailout. So that was a very, very challenging bill to craft and put together. But at the end of the day, yes, I think it was a good bill. I think unifying consumer protection is a terrific idea. I think dragging the derivatives markets, which, you know, dwarfed the stock markets into the light of day and trading on exchanges, that's all good stuff. Taking a good stab, I think, at doing away with too big to fail. Will it be perfect? No. You know, this will be like healthcare, something that we work on for years, but a really critical step forward.
Of course, the bill that just passed has created a regulator position for the new Consumer Protection Agency to be appointed by the president and housed in the Federal Reserve, and specifically to protect consumers of financial products. And the debate is now focused on who that regulator will be. Let's hear a short clip from ABC's This Week, where Secretary of the Treasury Tim Geithner weighs in on what appears to be his choice, Elizabeth Warren.
She is an enormously effective advocate for reform, probably the most effective advocate for reform for consumers, for consumer protection in the country. She has huge credibility. And she played a decisive role in helping make the public case for reform. And she was early on this, way ahead of everybody else.
2007, she wrote that she came up with.
And even before that, she was pointing out to people the risks of what was happening in the housing market and credit markets. So she has enormous credibility, and she'd be an excellent leader of that institution.
Congressman Himes, your background, I believe, comes out of the banking industry and as well as affordable housing, I think. And we've been hearing from some members of the banking world that they don't think Elizabeth Warren shares their worldview or has enough sympathy for the banking world. What do you think of that? And do you support Warren for the regulatory post?
Well, Elizabeth Warren is becoming a little bit of a political football, you know, and I think she's being largely unfairly painted as this, you know, very, very aggressive person who's going to damage the banking industry. You know, Elizabeth Warren was in my office about 9 months ago, and I got talking to her, and I asked her about some of the kind of uglier, shadier, sleazier products out there that that unfortunately are targeted often at our poorer population. I was talking about title loans and payday loans, and you know, you would have expected somebody somebody who was truly an ideologue to just say, oh, that's just awful, awful stuff. Her answer instead was, you know, for people who can't get credit cards, a title loan or a payday loan, you know, 80% of people will use those and use them responsibly, and 10% of the people who use them are committing financial suicide. And that just shows a sort of nuanced view. It's a non-ideological view. I have a great respect for Elizabeth Warren. I don't know who else the president is proposing to put in that position, but Elizabeth Warren is immensely knowledgeable on these things. I think she's a lot more practical than, unfortunately, is coming out in this, you know, highly politicized environment.
Do you think it says anything about the efficacy or perhaps well, I suppose it could be seen as a weakness or a strength of the financial bill that, of course, now what we're looking at is that so much is going to hinge on, for instance, who is in charge of the Consumer Protection Agency and who the regulators are who are implementing the bill, because so much has been left to regulators to interpret.
Yeah, you know, and I'm always of two minds on this. On the one hand, you know, there's always a tension between what you do in statute and what you leave to the regulators. The fact is, of course, the regulators understand the markets they regulate an awful lot better than Congress does. So, you know, Gary Gensler, who's worked in the industry and who really understands this stuff, really knows derivatives far better than anybody in Congress. So part of me says, you know, I'm not one of these turf guys that says, oh, no, Congress needs to retain authority. You know, particularly since you're talking about an innovative, adaptive industry, putting hard things in statute makes you a little bit uncomfortable. Of course, then you run the risk that a regulator comes in who doesn't care. That's not necessarily a resolvable tension. What I do hope, Isaac, and here's something that people don't talk about enough. What I do hope is that in the next 5 to 10 years, we work with Gary Gensler, with Mary Shapiro, with others to affect cultural change within the regulators, right? And without meaning any sort of derogatory towards lawyers, these are organizations that tend to be very lawyerly. You know, it's check-the-box regulation. It's rules-based. In an industry that changes and adapts as fast as the financial services industry, you need an entrepreneurial, adaptive regulator. They need to go out there and they need to hire traders. They need to hire guys who assembled these incredibly complicated derivatives, who know where you can bury the bodies, and who are going to look at Madoff. You know, 12.0% annual returns 10 years straight. Now, if you're checking boxes, you say, oh, well, that's great. If you know anything about the markets, you say, that's mathematically impossible. So we need to change the culture of these regulators in a more adaptable, innovative, more entrepreneurial mindset.
I want to get your take on one other thing that is certainly related to spending and possibly deficit reduction, but also relates to your work as a member of the Homeland Security Committee. I'm wondering if you've been following the Washington Post series on Top Secret America. And for those of our listeners who didn't see this, it's a series of in-depth stories from two Washington Post reporters about the U.S. intelligence community and about the fact that the organizations that make up the U.S. security apparatus, national security state, have become so large and so secretive that no one really knows what they are, what they're doing, where the money is going. What do you think about that series? What's your response to it? And what do you think that, for instance, your committee might do in response to that?
Well, yeah, that's a very complicated topic. You know, I see this from Congress. You know, we have oversight for the national security apparatus, and of course it is unbelievably fragmented here in Congress. You've got the Committee on Homeland Security, on which I sit. You've got the Committee on Intelligence. You've got Armed Services, because of course so much of the intelligence budget is in DOD. You know, you've got endless subcommittees. You've got highly fragmented oversight. And I'm sorry, but fragmented oversight is no oversight, and that really worries me. And of course it reflects the fragmentation that the Washington Post so highlighted. So you've got fragmentation, you've got a system so complicated that, yeah, the leadership admits, you know, the DNI admits that they don't really understand where everything is. Now we need to be a little careful here. The fact is, when you're thinking about preventing nuclear weapons coming onto the U.S. mainland, you actually want redundancy. So redundancy isn't necessarily a bad word, but complexity might be. We really, you know, you've got this $75 billion apparatus that seems, you know, to be complicated beyond the ability of the leadership to really understand it, that isn't clearly producing product that succeeds, right? I mean, we saw the shoe bomber, you know, just clues missed, all of this stuff. And we need to make allowances for the fact that many of the successes of the national security community will never be made public. But still, it makes you deeply uncomfortable. And again, we're talking about cultural change here. I do think we're in a better world than we were 10 years ago, where, you know, for example, example, the FBI and the CIA hated each other, but we've got a long way to go to make for an efficient, adaptable, pointed organization.
Well, and it would seem that if there is redundancy there, just taking one example, if there is redundancy there that is perhaps not making us safer, that this might be an area, if it is so sprawling and oversized, that might be ripe for some deficit reduction. But I wonder if A, this might even be more sacrosanct than the military budget, and some of it is the military budget, or and B, if it's possible to do deficit reduction in an area that's so secret lots of people don't even know what's going on.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the right question. You know, a member of Congress can look at the intelligence budget. I've done it myself. When a member of Congress wants to look at the intelligence budget, you go to a secure compartmented information facility buried deep in the Capitol. You sit with an individual. You give up your BlackBerry, your pens, your pencils. You don't take notes, and you look at a lot of very complicated verbiage. Now, I do know there are a few people running around who actually know what that complicated verbiage is. But again, that's not oversight. And so your point is exactly right. Now, you know, you choose. Do you want a world where you've got redundancy and maybe some fat in it, in a system that is designed to prevent a weapon of mass destruction, or do you want to risk in the other way, which is to say you've got a system that is so efficient and so lean that things could get through? That's a very legitimate argument to have, but your overall point is exactly right, which is if no one really understands how the whole system works, how can you possibly address its efficiency? How can you hold it accountable? How can you judge whether it's successful or not?
We've got to get going, unfortunately, but one last question for you, which is that there is, of course, a fight brewing soon, I believe, on Capitol Hill over the Bush-era tax cuts expiring. And especially as we talk about cutting the deficit, I'm wondering, A, how you see that fight playing out, and B, if those cuts do expire, does that essentially give you a little more money to work with, or is that money already planned for and spent?
Well, yeah, and you can imagine how thrilled I am that this discussion is going to occur in the months leading into November, right?
Because,
I mean, it's just going to – the discussion, unfortunately, in public is going to be silly. The Republicans are going to be pounding the table saying you have to be more fiscally responsible, but you have to make permanent these tax cuts, which they won't tell you cost $2 trillion or so. You know, the Democrats will be, you know, talking about how important it is that we, you know, increase taxes on the wealthy. It's going to be a really silly discussion. You know, the reality, the way I think about it is this. You know, just as you don't dramatically slash spending in a very tenuous recovery, you also don't substantially increase your tax burden. Economically, those are similar things in terms of their effect on the economy. So I think we need to proceed very, very carefully here. I haven't formulated a final opinion, but I do think we should, in particular on those households making less than $250,000, which, you know, certainly in my district, you know, fall somewhere in the middle class category, you know, we should think very seriously about at least temporarily extending those. You know, for higher incomes, we need to be very conscious of the fact that you've got a lot of small business owners who, you know, who report that business income as personal income, but they may not pay it to themselves. They may want to recycle that back into the small business, and we need to be very careful that we don't put a disincentive on small businesses to grow right now. So a very complicated issue that unfortunately is going to be demagogued up the wazoo between now and November, but one that unfortunately requires very nuanced handling.
But certainly the it would appear that the House Democratic leadership is very much in favor of letting these expire, and you're saying that you may be in favor of extending them. You may go against them on this in addition to some of the deficit talk.
Well, again, you know, my principle with respect to fiscal responsibility is that all discussions are on the table. You know, interestingly enough, you say that the Democratic leadership wants to let these tax cuts expire. In any rational world, people who are hardcore fiscal responsibility people, which, you know, used to be an accolade that was cherished by the Republican Party, they would also say let those things expire because you can't fix our fiscal situation with them. So unfortunately, that's not the world we live in. But, you know, it is a discussion we're going to have. The choice is between lowering tax burdens on largely higher income Americans or, and it's not and, it's or, seriously addressing our fiscal deficit.
We'll have to leave it there. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, filling in for Brian Lehrer. I've been talking with Congressman Jim Himes from Connecticut's 4th District. Congressman Himes, thanks so much for being with us on WNYC.
Thanks a lot, Isaac.
Coming up next, an update on what has and what hasn't changed at Guantanamo Bay. Stay tuned.